Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It is June 19th, 2022. Happy Father's Day to everyone. And this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC. Or you can contact me via email, jason@overthecap.com. I am not joined by Nelly the Bunny this week. There is no Nelly this week. I'm in a different location for this week. So hopefully this sounds okay. This is not my usual setup at all for doing the podcast. It's been one of those weeks. Last weekend, my wife got COVID. I ended up with a skin infection unrelated to COVID, and then I caught COVID. So basically, I've been in a little bit of an isolation area pretty much since, I guess, Monday of last week. So, you know, we've been trying to keep the kids, and the kids so far haven't had it. So that's been a good thing. So obviously no beer of the week this week is, you know, recording this on a Sunday, but between everything going on, definitely no beer this week. But luckily the kids haven't caught it yet, which is good because we're supposed to go away this week. And obviously if they catch it, then that's it. We'll be cleared from the quarantine periods by then. But we've decided to just try to keep away from them as much as possible. You know, as much as you can. Obviously, you can't just leave them to their own devices. But yeah, so hasn't been a great week with that. The COVID stuff, you know, it's not great. I got pretty tired from it, achy. You know, I don't know. I guess everyone's experience is different. My experience was worse with the shot, to be honest. But this lingered for much longer. You know, the shot was basically 36 hours, I would say, where I just kind of felt miserable. This was just like a constant ache for like a couple of days, ache and pain, you know, kind of joints bugging you, try to get up and you're a bit kind of dizzy, disoriented kind of stuff. You know, my wife seemed more like almost like a bronchitis was her reaction to it. At first, I thought I was actually having a reaction to something else, even though we knew she had it at the time. You know, and I thought I was okay until my nose started to get a little stuffy. And then once that happened, I go, okay, that shouldn't be a side effect of anything. And did the COVID test, and there you go. So, yeah, definitely been one of those weeks. So, you know, hopefully most of you guys were able to avoid getting this stuff. Yeah, so anyway, we'll try to get a podcast in. Shouldn't be too long of a one. I'm just going to do just a quick overview this week. I'm Minka Fitzpatrick, you know, since I'll try to do this one quicker, and then we'll just do whatever questions came in, and we'll wrap it up. I think last week we got this done an hour and a half. Maybe we'll even get this one in an hour today. So, yeah, the big news of the week was Minka Fitzpatrick of the Pittsburgh Steelers signs a record-setting extension as the highest-paid safety in the history of the NFL. It's essentially a $73 million extension for 4 years. The actual value is $72.988 million. The difference there is just that a lot of teams will throw an extra couple of bucks in there to balance out the old money in the contract. The existing money in his contract was $10.612 million. They didn't go through all that nonsense of adding an extra, you know, 12 grand or whatever to it to balance the numbers out. But basically it's 72.9, 988 is the number. So it's 73, 36 million guaranteed at signing. So Pittsburgh does for the second time come off of their guaranteed stance. So they did this with TJ Watt. They did not do this with their contracts in free agency, but they did do it again here with Fitzpatrick. Now, Watt and Fitzpatrick both are the highest paid players at their respective positions. So I don't know if we're going to totally read into Pittsburgh doing it yet, but I think this might have been, it's Omar Khan's first contract as GM rather than just as negotiator. So maybe this is just him saying, okay, we're going to enter the modern world of the NFL and do these kind of contracts. When you look at the numbers, they probably didn't have to do it because this is a contract that's kind of mind-blowing. So if you look at this, it validates the Jamal Adams contract. No one had really been able to do that yet, and That's not to say that these other players were as highly regarded as Fitzpatrick, but the Jamal Adams contract has still been sitting out there at 17.5 as kind of like a scratch your head. He's not really having an impact in Seattle. If anything, this should cause the market to kind of shrink up a little bit. And for the most part, everything has been based on these $15 million deals, with the exception of Harrison Smith. I forgot about Harrison Smith at 16. But yeah, Justin Simmons, 15.25. Buda Baker, 14.75. Eddie Jackson, well, that's a much older one, at 14.6. You had Marcus Williams this offseason at 14. Diggs this offseason at 13. You know, and now you got Jesse Bates sitting there on the franchise tag. And Bates is very clearly going to look to earn 18.5. I would think a year, or 19 a year. And this is going to set the stage for your first $20 million year safety. I don't think that that is out of the realm of possibilities at this point, unless whomever the next safeties may be that come up, unless they're just with a team that doesn't want to be the first team to go to 20 for the position. I would say this sets the stage for it. And this will eliminate any blowback that was going to come from the Adams disaster out in Seattle. So you look at the numbers here, and the full guarantee on this is $36 million. The next closest player has $32 guaranteed. The next closest after that is $22. So, I mean, it's a massive number that they guaranteed in full. Injury protection is not as big on this. It's just the 36, which puts it third in the league. That's obviously still pretty big. It's right under Marcus Williams, but Williams is signed for 5 years. This is four, so you could justify a lower total on a five versus four. And then Adams got the 38 compared to the 36. Now, you might look at the concept of new money, effective value, and that might have come into play here, because if you take that into account, yeah, they do probably balance out right around the same total as to what the new guarantees were on that deal. But that's where those numbers come in. As far as the signing bonus, it's the second largest signing bonus given to a safety behind Adams, $20 million. First year cash is real big on this one. So it's 25.4. And that's a real big number. So that jumps Jamal Adams. That will rank, let me see where that ranks among players first year. Should be first, I think, unless the Ravens did something with Williams. No. So Fitzpatrick's first year new money is going to be $25.4 million. That's about $400,000 more than Jamal Adams' total in that there. When you get to the second year, this is where this one really stands out to me. And this is where you go, when you see these numbers, you kind of say to yourself, well, why didn't you just do this last year? Now, I know they're going to switch general managers, but the stability in that organization kind of tells you that they're probably going to promote from within. And this is the basis of the discussion that was kind of there last week. Why don't you extend early? What has to happen to a player to be so bad that you would go from saying, we're going to extend him, to we're not going to extend him at all? And more often than not, especially with these players you trade for and these players that have a high draft grade, and so Fitzpatrick fits both of those categories, you know, these are players that you're not going to step away from. So he does take a step back last year, I think, as a player. We had him rated pretty low, which means, for the most part, it means that the stuff he did with PFF wasn't that good. With the way they graded him. If you look at the statistics compared to the stats from other safeties that are a little bit more meaningful, he wasn't very good. Didn't really stand out in that regard. His snap count total was probably reasonable. You know, he played 16 games, so he probably was out there for, I'm just looking it up. So basically he's out there for every snap in the games he plays. So that's not a problem, but that was his best trait last year. So you get to that second year cash total, it's almost $40 million. And if there's a reason why maybe they didn't throw that extra 12 grand in there, maybe it's because they didn't want the 2 year cash on this to read 40 million. It's 39.888 million. That's there. It would have had to be more than the extra 12. I thought it was 39.98. I'm sorry. Yeah, the that one there. So, you know, it's just a weird one. Like, Jamal Adams is at 36. Justin Simmons, Marcus Williams, 32. So, I don't know what the thought was here. If you're going to go that big, do this deal last year. You know, his price didn't go down. Didn't matter. The safety market didn't move, obviously. The very least, you probably would have gotten something a little better. You probably would have been able to get better terms in terms of your cash layouts. Now, maybe they were in a position where they had some cap problems last year, so maybe that played a role as well as to why they didn't do it. But, I know their cap was bad, but you can almost make anything work. And, you know, these numbers are huge. Year three, he's going to make $55.4 compared to Jamal Adams at $52.5. The next group down is $46.5. And then he's going to be at 73 versus 70. So the year two cash flow to me is the thing that really stands out here. He's basically a $20 million a year player in the first two extension years. So we're talking about 2022, 23, and 24. So the new money in those three over those three seasons make up the two-year cash flow number. And I think that's a terrific contract for him. I think it's a very questionable contract for the Steelers. They have a ton of money invested in their defense. I looked it up. I think I closed it out. I don't think I saved my search that I did on that. But they had a massive differential between offensive and defensive spending, on top players. It was the biggest in the league by a large, large, large amount. You know, people were bringing up the point, well, you know, all these teams have rookie quarterbacks. And that's true. Steelers are kind of in limbo. They do have a rookie quarterback, but it's questionable as to whether he will be the quarterback this year or not. Could very well be Mitchell Trubisky, who does work in the top of their offensive salaries. Top of their offensive salaries include two quarterbacks. It's got Trubisky and Mason Rudolph, just to give you an idea of how little they spend on their offense right now. In fact, let me just pull up what they have as their top contracts on that team. So yeah, obviously when you don't have the big quarterback under contract, you do tend to spend more on defense. That's fine. But most teams, it's still within $10 million. You find ways to balance it out. So here's the Steelers. So their commitment to T.J. Watt is $28 a year. Fitzpatrick is $18.3 a year. Then you have Cameron Hayward at $16.4. Okafor is your highest paid offensive player at $9.75, followed by James Daniels at $8.8. You have Miles Jack at $8 million. Then you got Trubisky at $7.4. Mason Cole's at 5'3", Mason Rudolph 4'9". So you can see this is a very top-heavy roster defensively, and that's going to be their approach this year. Now, historically, the Steelers obviously have been a defense-first team. Last couple of years, I'd say, I know people didn't like their defense last year. I thought they were still okay. You do have to question, I think sometimes, not adding or being able to maintain on the other side of the football. And, you know, they're probably going to have to make some decisions there. Maybe they're going to spend on Deontay Johnson, and that'll up some of those offensive values. And, you know, maybe there's a couple other players that they're going to consider. But they'll have to make some kind of investment, certainly by next year, I would think, to change the way that the team is going to be laid out, because it's just too top heavy on one side of the football, and just not enough probably being spent in the other area. Unless you end up with everybody on rookie contracts on offense really contributing at a high level, I don't know if you can really get by where you don't have, any offensive lineman over $10 million. you maybe will have one wide receiver over 10, but, you know, probably another still on a rookie contract. You know, it just doesn't seem like a recipe necessarily for success. So I think it's going to be kind of curious to see how they approach this moving forward, if they're going to be a team that actually looks a little bit more into free agency in the future, just to try to fill some of these spots, you know, because it's probably going to, kind of create, imbalances that you might not be able to make up so easily in the draft. You know, you want to find a way, I think, to ensure that when your rookie quarterback takes over, which you have to imagine is probably going to be at some point this season, that you start ensuring that they have the different pieces in place, you know, around him. Now, you're going to get this benefit of having the cheap quarterback spend in other areas of your offense. Even if you love the guys on the team, you know, spend a little bit, you know, spend somewhat on other factors, even if it's just going to be insurance policies for some of these other players that you possibly believe in. As for the safety market now, you know, I just think that this really is a big move for them. Safety's been stagnant for so long, and you saw with the Harrison Smith deal, which was just lunacy by Minnesota, you started to say, wow, you know, maybe something is going to change when that one went in there. And the way that one changed, I think, was people looking at it and saying, this is insane. You can't pay a old safety this kind of money. And then as you saw Jamal Adams kind of fall apart, I think you looked at it that way and said, what are we paying these safeties this kind of money for? And this creates like a real interesting opportunity, I think, for certain teams. Some people are going to look at this, and I don't know if I got questions about it. I know I got questions right after the signing. People don't like my take on Baltimore, which was basically that I thought that it was kind of a waste for them to draft a safety in the first round. Again, this just heavy my opinion on, you know, positional values and availability and stuff like that. And immediately that kind of brought some questions out. Well, does that justify it now? You know, does this make you change your opinion? The answer is no. It's still just one player whose salary is this high. But again, you get to the point, and it's kind of the same thing with corners a little bit too. And it's the concept that you do have a lot of these players available in free agency, and they're not going to cost you this amount of money. So the question becomes, are you better off signing a player in free agency, even if you're going to draft a guy like this or trade for him? Are you better off just playing out the rookie years and then signing someone cheaper, you know, or do you extend? So your top market players, all the 14 pluses, 14 one up, are all extensions. So that's Fitzpatrick, Adams, Smith, Simmons, Baker, Jackson, and Byard. Now, two of those guys were traded for, but that's your top of the market. Then you get into your free agents, and these are not bad players. Marcus Williams, Quandre Diggs could have gone to free agency. I don't remember exactly when he re-upped with Seattle. Bates is on a franchise tag. Johnson in Cleveland was a free agent. Reed going to the Chiefs, he was 10-5. Poyer and Hyde were extensions. Jimmy Ward, 9-5. Matthew, 9. McCourty is old. He's not going anywhere. Then you get into the category of your Rayshon Jenkins, 8-7-5. Tracy Walker, 8-3. Marcus May coming off injury, 7-5. Jordan Whitehead, 7-3. Von Bell at 6. I mean, these are decent players. They're not bad players. And, you know, you're basically almost at a point where you could go out and you could sign yourself to Marcus Mays and, a veteran like a PJ Williams, LaMarcus Joyner type of player, you know, and basically that would cost you the same as one. So I think it's as the numbers get higher, because I don't anticipate the back end of the market pulling up, because the activity in free agency hasn't been enough. That there hasn't been proof of that, that the back end of these markets is going to rise as much as the top end players. So I think that that is going to be real. It's already been an interesting question, but as the numbers get close to 20 and you can start putting together concepts to where you can get three safeties for the price of one, I think that that makes a interesting way to think about it. And I think that actually should put more weight on the decision-making now as to what you do. Now, if the safety position does get really bumped up at the top, then I could see some justifications actually for drafting a player high if you think he can develop him and trade him towards the end of his contract. You know, get the benefit of those cheap years and then pull a number one back. Or maybe even two if you find someone crazy enough like Seattle. But mainly you're going to get one back. So I guess I could see that maybe a little bit as maybe some type of line of thinking. But it'll be interesting because Bates is going to be the next test case, and the Bengals are not going to budge off their guarantee structure. I would say that this probably is going to mean that Bates is going to become a free agent next year. He might get tagged again. Actually, just looking at the numbers, he'll probably get tagged two times. This might lead into a nasty situation. Because I don't think the Bengals are going to go that high, but he doesn't have any leverage because of the franchise tag values being so low at the position. So they could probably just play him out for 2 years. You have Derwin James. He's probably going to be the guy that hits 20, assuming he stays healthy. That's the main thing, is that he has to remain healthy if he's going to get there, because there has been enough, I think, on him to where you do at least have to be concerned somewhat about that. But you're going to get into a position now with this group where you're really going to have a lot of questions that you can ask, because before this, when the market was really stuck at 14 or 15, all right, there at least you started to have kind of legitimate questions. Are you better off investing in the high-end player at 14? Or did you want to get, one moderate player who was going to cost you 7 and then another moderate player that would cost you like 5 and then, throw in a cheaper rookie or a minimum salary guy, and say that's kind of your competition level. If you were just talking about investing X amount of dollars at this one position. With the numbers getting close to that 20 now, and assuming that's where the market is going to head, I think that dramatically changes it, because now you're talking about two pretty good guys that you can sign in free agency, and a third who's not a minimum salary guy, but, like more of like a veteran $2-3 million player. And remember, when you do those kind of signings, you probably get a little more flexibility out of it. Not just in terms of the salary cap stuff, but the guarantees are going to be much lower. So you probably have the flexibility to move on much quicker. And, in the case of the veteran guys, that's a revolving door, right? Those kind of guys for $2-3 million are like 1 year contracts. So every year you can kind of add a new face if you want to. So, that was the big news of the week, and that was just a couple of thoughts on that one. Let's take a look here at questions, and then we'll call this one a night. So let me just pull these up. That's yesterday, and then just now. All right, I had a couple in the email. Let's start with email. All right, let's see. From Max, do you agree with the Bears' decision to go with the scorched earth approach, or should they have used the small portion of next year's cap space to build something functional around Fields? Generally, the opinion the quarterbacks will succeed or not based on their own ability, and bad supporting cast won't sink them. But my fear is Fields is in such a bad position, it'll be almost impossible for him to be successful. Contrast with Jacksonville, who probably spends in an inefficient manner, but at least Lawrence has a functioning NFL talent around him. I agree with the Bears' decision. I understand where people are coming from with this and where people are thinking that Fields has no chance. I also agree with the concept that if a quarterback has it, they're going to have it. He would show you stuff and you would see things to where people, if he's the guy, he will show you stuff to where you start looking at a couple of those receivers and people talk about the Bears receivers not being bad versus the Bears receivers being terrible. And if he's got the goods, you'll see throws that are being made and passes that are being dropped or routes that are just completely off where people are going to start to say, well, you know, if they had a functioning NFL caliber offense there, he would go from good to great. You know, if he's bouncing the football at people's feet, if he's sailing the ball over someone's head by 10 yards, if he's constantly throwing to the other team, you know, those are signs of a bad quarterback. And that has nothing to do a lot of times with the talent around him. The negative on the lack of talent, I think, comes more on the mental side. You know, maybe that gets into a player's head. Again, my opinion on it is that the great quarterbacks would kind of shirk that off. Like, would they get mad about it? Sure, they might get mad that they don't have the greatest talent around them. But you know, the Peyton Mannings, the Tom Brady's, those guys would always rise to the occasion. It doesn't matter who they're going to be out there with. They're going to find a way to make those guys useful players. You know, when the Colts beat up the Jets in the playoffs that one year, they had Revis to take away Manning's top player. So what happened? Well, he just started throwing to the other guys on the team, and they took advantage of the Jets' other corners like Lito Shepard, and I don't remember who their third was at that time. You know, they basically took advantage of that and, you know, beat them up, and that led to the Jets the next year going with what I think was actually the best strategy a team could do, and that was drafting Kyle Wilson in the first round. Now, he didn't work out, but they drafted him in the first round, and then they made a trade for Antonio Cromartie because the realization was they had the greatest season ever by a cornerback, and he couldn't shut down a hot quarterback because the guys around him were not very good. So, you know, I think that, you know, your great quarterbacks, you know what they're doing. The other issue is just that when you do have a bad team, and Chicago is going to be bad this year, barring the first-year coach bump, which does happen at times, even with bad teams. You know, you catch teams off guard. They don't know what to expect. They're not really prepared for you. They take you pretty lightly, and things start to kind of go your way, and next thing you know, you look decent. Barring that, I would think they're going to be really bad this year. And when a team is bad like that, the media for the team is probably going to start talking about making a change. That he's less successful on the field than Trubisky. And they went down this road with Trubisky and they waited too long and that sunk the team. And it's not Poles' guy. And, you know, they're kind of hampered with him because they inherited him. And then you're going to start hearing those narratives drive up. That'll come in the articles. That'll come from the fans. It'll be all over social media. And that can lead to, you know, who knows, especially in this day and age, quarterback looking to go somewhere else. You know, that could be something that could lead to something. I think that's true. But if you want to make the most of Justin Fields' rookie years with the team, and you want to give him the best chance to succeed and the organization the best chance to succeed, I think this is the way you have to play it. Because if they went and they doubled down again this year on that roster, and the only way that they could have put something functional around him was going to be to double down on the roster. You know, it was going to be to keep a guy like Mac and restructure the deal. And you know, maybe, well, probably not Trevathan's deal, but, you know, a couple other guys, you know, probably restructure their deals and then sign a couple of players in free agency who are really B-level talents, and you're going to end up overpaying for them to come to Chicago. And, you know, that's going to hamper you next year because, yeah, even though you could look at it and say, well, you know, you could have borrowed $30 million in cap room from next year, it's not really just borrowing $30 million from next year. It's really borrowing something more like $60 million, because you know, you're borrowing the money and you're going to have to pay those players the following year as well, because they're still going to be on the team. So it's not like they can be 1 year players and then you move on and then you say, okay, well now we've got 70 million in cap space and we'll build the team. It's more like, okay, we're going to borrow 30 via restructures and everything else. And now we're going to be committed to a couple of these players for probably another 30 next year. So we borrowed 30, we committed 30. The players we're not even really happy with. We just, we're throwing them out there because we just want them on the field to give Fields a fighting chance this one season. I would let the team get used to everything that they do. I would let the coaches get used to it. I'd let the GM get used to it. I'd let them evaluate the talent that's on the field. I'd let them evaluate the talent in the locker room and evaluate the quarterback via practice and the games, see his approach, and you know, decide what are the areas that you really need to improve in. What are the areas you have to invest in free agency? What do you think you can do in the draft the following year to get better? That at least gives you a window to really do much better for the next 2 or 3 years of Fields' career if he's a decent quarterback. And I think if they went the other approach, it just would have been worse. I think they would have had a harder time, you know, kind of getting to that next level. So I don't think they could have gotten there. Peter says, a couple weeks ago, you were talking about Arthur Smith. Okay, so this is more of like a comment. Thinks that Arthur Smith basically is, you know, just kind of a jerk to people. And that's probably true. You know, he denounces, this is, from this, regularly denounced anyone who hasn't played the game, dismisses them outright. If he's simply smarter or knows better. Yeah, you know, that's absolutely true. I think there are many coaches in the league that are that way. I think there's some executives that way. I think it's a very old school mentality that unless you are involved in the game day to day on, you know, 24/7 kind of basis, your opinion doesn't really matter. I think that that's definitely the case from some, and he probably does give off those vibes, you know, and that's one of those things where if the team continues to lose, that's probably going to be a problem. Now, I don't know as much on the way the Atlanta market is. You know, in New York, that kind of stuff won't fly. Like, you'll get bounced after a season or two if you have that kind of act. I don't know if it's more forgiving in Atlanta, depending on how the team performs, I guess. But, yeah, I could see that where you just kind of have that personality and you know, you start being contrarian just for the sake of being contrarian. And, you know, you say something stupid, which maybe you didn't even mean to say, but now you have to double down on it because you said it. And you don't want to say that, well, you know, I kind of messed up or I didn't mean that. You know, you just take a hard line stance and say, well, it is what it is. I could see that with him. All right, let's see these questions here. Paulie, if Deshaun Watson doesn't accrue a season due to suspension, will he still have 5 years left on his deal in 2023? So has nothing to do with accruing a season. He would still have 5 years left. So if he's suspended for the whole year, his contract will toll to 2023. So the money he was set to earn this year, he would earn next year. It's not really... It's not something to where this year doesn't count and he only has 4 years left for the Browns. The contract would carry over for a season. It might impinge on some personal and professional relationships, but you have more confidence in PFF offensive grades than defensive ones. I feel the defensive ones are very suspect, but could simply reflect that it's impossible to know the scheme and responsibilities. I can't really say one way or the other as to whether I'd have more confidence. I like the work they do. I use their grades for a lot of the stuff that we do. There's certain things that they track that I think are correlated pretty well with some of the contract stuff that we do. There's some stuff that isn't. I think the biggest issue that I've ever had with the grades, I think is a lot of times that the grades, and maybe this is just from my perspective of having to kind of deal with the contract stuff, and for the valuations we do and that other kind of stuff, I'll make adjustments based on snaps that players play. I do think that there's you're grading a player on a certain number of snaps, and this is probably more for defense than offense, because offense, your offensive line is playing every snap, your quarterback's playing every snap, your receivers are playing pretty often, whereas defense, you got a lot of guys coming in, coming out, and it's not like you don't on offense, but you have a lot of guys that come on and off the field on defense. And sometimes it's hard when you see grade, you see a grade of a player who, let's say he's got a grade of like a 73, which is, you know, pretty decent. But he's only playing 30% of the snaps or 25% of the snaps. It's kind of hard to take that as like the same value, even as a player who's like a 68, but is playing, you know, 75% of the snaps. Sometimes I'll trust the teams that there's a reason why those other guys are not playing. And, you know, maybe when they do get more opportunities, they prove me wrong, and, you know, their performance kind of stays the same. I think the reason why people probably look at the defensive grades as being less of a thing. Thank you, Megan. All right. That was a Megan guest appearance right there. See, when we're upstairs, we get more of that. Yes, Megan.
Yay, I need my dancing
room back. Okay. Goodbye, Megan. Yes, this doubles as Megan's dancing practice room, so she's out of practice while I'm in this room. Anyway, with the grades, I think the big reason, and this is some of the trouble, the stuff that's hard sometimes with even doing the contract stuff defensively versus offensively. Most stuff on offense is pretty statistical, right? You know, you know if a quarterback is pretty good or not. You know if wide receivers are playing well. You know if running backs are doing okay. Even offensive linemen, which are hard to measure. You know, if your quarterback's not getting bounced around and you've got a pretty decent running game when you attempt to run, you know, you have a good feeling that your line is doing pretty well. And if you're a fan of the team, you know the guys who can't block and you know the guys who can. Just because you know where pressure constantly is coming from on your quarterbacks. So you kind of see that. On defense, there's a lot more to it. You know, you will see some teams still that get enamored with huge amounts of tackles. It's a lot less than it used to be. A lot of times, tackles don't mean anything. Now, when you have a bunch of linebackers or safeties making a bunch of tackles, sometimes it really doesn't mean much. You know, it means something if they're at the line or behind the line of scrimmage, or maybe if it's stopping someone from a first down on third down. But a lot of times it's just kind of like, you know, you're picking up somebody else's mistake. You're just fixing it. It's like if the team had, you know, if you have a linebacker with 100 tackles, you know, that probably just tells you if you had a better defensive line, he wouldn't be getting the opportunity for all those tackles. And I think sometimes you probably see guys that have good statistical numbers on defense, like a bunch of tackles and stuff like that. And from a grading perspective, you might look at the guy making the tackle and go, well, he's only making the tackle because he blew a coverage, or he's making a tackle 6 yards down the field because the defensive line couldn't hold. You know, cornerback that makes a bunch of interceptions, it's all well and good, but when he's given up a bunch of receptions at the same time, you know, there's a lot of negatives that are coming with that same player. Yeah, he's a gambler, but what happens when the gambles don't pay off anymore? And so I think defensively, that's probably why people look at those grades and they have a harder time kind of wrapping their head around some of them, and they'll say, well, you know, this guy's an all-pro, or this guy is, you know, really great, and you're trying to tell me that he's not the best player at the position and he's barely above average. And I just think it's just because of the way those positions, sometimes I think it's just that the statistics sometimes at those positions, what we track on them, masks a lot of weaknesses and over implies strengths that sometimes don't really exist for those players. And that's why sometimes when they do go move to another team and another scheme, it doesn't stand out as well. Or one of the reasons why there is a lot of variance sometimes year to year with those defenses, some of these guys who look really good from a numbers standpoint, well, you know, that guy made a bunch of tackles at linebacker. You know, when the next year comes and, you know, you weren't facing that many runs because now you were playing competitively on offense and you start to realize this guy can't cover. Like, now he's a liability because instead of playing run all the time, we got to play pass and he's a liability. And then on top of that, you short up your front. So in the situations where the team is running, well, your defensive tackles, maybe you're plugging it up now and he's getting stopped after a 2 yard gain or a 3 yard gain instead of making it to the linebacker who's there at six. You know, Saab, I know I'm picking on linebackers, but that's the one that bugs me the most is when the people bring up the tackle numbers. I think for a lot of those guys, he's a tackling machine. And trust me, that does still play a big factor for a lot of these teams when they sign the players to contracts. But I think that's probably a reason why that the grades, people have less confidence in them. Native Son, one comment, Deshaun Watson. I don't really have anything else to say about him. You know, I mentioned about him last week. I think you can tell he's an addict. He probably should have at some point agreed to go for some type of counseling instead of just, you know, coming out and saying, I don't really know why we're in this position we're in right now. You know, they're going to have to deal with it the whole season. Whatever comes and goes with him, they're going to have to deal with. It doesn't look good for Cleveland. It doesn't look good for the Browns because all they've done as well is just buried their heads in the sand with it, and they're just waiting for the football season to arrive. And they figure once the games start, the criticism will die down somewhat. It won't nationally, but I think their hope is locally any concerns will die down because he'll be out there and he should make them a competitive football team. So I kind of think they're hoping that kind of happens. Is there any benefit to front-loading contracts since you can roll over cap every year? Front-loading from a salary cap perspective? I mean, yes and no. It depends probably on the state you are as a team. You know, there might be some benefits to it to give you more flexibility. Like, you know, the year that the 49ers did it with Garoppolo, I thought that made a lot of sense because it gave them a bunch of outs in the contract. Now, they never exercised those outs, but it gave them a bunch of outs in that contract that don't function the same, even just from a PR standpoint, if you have to cut a player. Look, if you carry a player like that on your salary cap for 1 year at $40 million, and the next year he's 25, and then the next year after that you can cut him, and he's only $8 million on the cap, versus doing something like, I don't know, $20 million the first year, we'll say the same $25 million the next year, and then next thing you know, it's a $30 million dead money hit. That looks awful for you as a team. You know, the end result is kind of the same. It looks awful for you as a team. You know, so I think there's a little bit of a benefit to that. Now, in terms of the cash flows, no, you don't want to do that if you're a team. You want to protect yourself as much as possible, but I assume you mean from a salary cap standpoint. So, yeah, it also, to be honest, it keeps you from doing stupid stuff. Like, one of the worst things that happens to teams is they do stupid stuff because they get enamored with something. You know, like Atlanta, the year they signed Dante Fowler, it's like you wanted to be in a position where you couldn't do anything with your salary cap, to where you kind of had to tell your general manager, there is no possible way that we can add this player to the team. Like, there's no possible way you could do that. You know, there's no possible way that you could add this particular free agent to our team. And you can do that sometimes with the salary cap structure and kind of say, well, you know, we didn't want to tinker with these deals. That was our thing. We didn't want to touch them. So I kind of think it also prevents you from doing stupid stuff from time to time. But, you know, that would be my thought there. Last week you said you would have Burrow and Herbert play year to year to maximize money. What would the contract have to look like for them to sign an extension? Would you lean almost always going year to year to maximize earnings for other positions? So the only positions that you can go year to year on would be quarterback and left tackle. That would be it. You could do it at other offensive line positions, but normally they're not tagged. So, I mean, I guess if you want to throw a guard out there, I'll say a guard, you can go year to year as well, because we've seen one or two get tagged. But in terms of actual franchise tag possibilities, it's those two positions. The reason I say those two positions and not something like an edge rusher, the main reasons for that, as players get older, they get less and less attractive to teams in the NFL. Players are most attractive to 32 teams when they're like 25 years and younger. I'll say 26 and younger. They're still pretty attractive at 27. At 28, some teams are going to start to get turned off. At 29, they're definitely going to start to get turned off. And at 30, you know, you really might hit a panic button except for one or two teams. Now, you may always find a team. You know, Tremaine Johnson found the Jets. But by and large, at those positions, you have an expiration date. And the expiration date comes up quick. Quarterbacks are expected to be functional until they're 35. And I think many teams nowadays consider quarterbacks to be functional until they're almost 40. I don't think that really bears out on the field. But I think there's teams clearly with the way they approach some of these contracts, they do believe that their players are going to be good until they're at least 40. But I think 35 or 36 is the years there. So you can go on two franchise tags and then you basically have free run the rest of your career and just do a bunch of Kirk Cousins deals, do a bunch of 3-year contracts. You know, you'll keep moving with the market by doing something like that. Left tackle is another position where I think most people probably give that until 32, 33 to be at a pretty functional level. And in some cases, they're probably looking at older players and saying they're still capable. So I can probably give up free agency at 27 and 28, and I can sign a much bigger deal at 29 and, you know, go that way. So I think you would stand to earn more money by taking, you know, a tag when you're 27, a tag when you're 28, signing a 3-year deal when you're 29, or maybe a 5-year deal even. You know, you might be able to get that, which will take you to 33. Let's say you get to the end of that contract and you still might get another deal. And I think that you're better off doing that than you would be signing the bigger deal in when you're 27. And having that carry you all the way through 31 and then hoping at 32 that you can get that next deal. So I think you're better off playing it that way at those positions. I think if you want to do the deals, you know, as a quarterback, I would probably look up and I would have to look to see what the exclusive franchise tag is going to be. Let's take a quick look here. Let me take a look. So, for example, when is Herbert going to be a free agent? I don't even know. But let's just I'll use 2023 as an example. It's going to be after that. You know, but the example we'd be looking at here, let's take a look. So your exclusive tag is going to be, roughly 45.5. Let's just call it 45 million. So your second year salary would be 54. Your third year salary would be 78. So, I mean, that right there is a 3-year total of 177. Let me see how that compares to some of the guys now. Let's see, top 10 quarterbacks. All right, let me look at the top 10 quarterbacks by 3-year metric. So your 3-year cash tops right now is Aaron Rodgers at 151. So I would say to get the ball rolling, I would need an offer that's going to give me 177 over 3 years, which would be about 59 million a year. And then we can go from there. So I think you would be looking for a contract if you were going to sign a long-term deal. Right now, I think you would need to be given an offer that's in the ballpark of $60 million a year. You know, as a young quarterback, to be willing to do that, because the franchise tag numbers are just too high, and you know, you're not really sacrificing that much. I mean, you're basically what you're looking at here is your top market first year take home for your top quarterbacks, 75 million, 68.4, and 66. After that, it drops down to 46, 42, 6, and 42. So let's say 75 is your high watermark, your top of the market. So you're going to be underwater by 30 million. By the next year, you know, by the 2 years, you're going to be at 99 if they play the franchise tag game. And the only quarterback that's going to earn more than that in 2 years would be Aaron Rodgers, who's going to earn 101. Josh Allen's at 98.4, 97 for Stafford, 95 for Prescott, 92 for Watson, 83 for Goff. So if the tag is going to get you 2 years and be the number two paid quarterback over a 2-year period, and by far have the biggest contract in the NFL if you're going over a 3-year period, why in the world would, you know, you not want to do that? You're only deferring your money for, at the most, for 1 year. You know, and yeah, like I said, there is that risk for injury, but it's pretty limited at this position. So I think I would have to set my sights at a contract that probably ran for no more than 4 years and would average somewhere around $60 million a year, new money, to do a deal. I think that would be the only way that would make sense. Basically, you would be, by doing a 4-year deal, you would be giving the team the fourth year at a discount by doing a 4-year deal. But I think that those are the numbers, because otherwise it just makes more sense to just play it out. Let's see. Can you preview what a 2023 Cowboys offseason might look like? We might have to make some tough decisions on Elliott. That's not a tough decision. Smith and others, while also pondering extensions. Flam, Diggs, and Schultz, if they can't work one before this year's tag deadline. I'm not really sure. I haven't looked close enough at Dallas. I think you're going to have to see. I think it's too early to talk about Dallas because I think Dallas is going to be a team that is probably going to consider a coaching change if things don't go well. So, you know, that always makes it hard to really project, you know, what teams are going to do and what they're going to think. But yeah, I mean, Elliott's definitely gone. Smith is going to depend on how well he plays. They're locked in on Lawrence. Martin's not going to go anywhere. You know, Elliott's really the guy who's going to go. Everything else, you know, just looking at the numbers, I mean, there's nothing, you know, that crazy there. You know, most of their guys are, you know, kind of whatever. So basically it's going to be, you'll free up a couple of bucks with Elliott. You'll restructure Prescott. You know, maybe restructure one other player. You know, but I think Dallas's extensions and all that stuff, they're probably all going to come in 24. You know, they'll probably play things slow like they seemingly always do. And, you know, they'll do those deals then. I don't think you saw my question from last week. You planning on going to any games this season? I don't think so. You know, Jacob still, even though he's 7, like I was more interested in seeing this stuff live when I was that age. He doesn't seem to be. And, you know, I have a feeling if we went to any games, his entertainment at the game would be probably watching the game on an iPad while at the game. So I don't know. Maybe we'll go to a game or something, but I don't, it's not on my plan. Zach says, thoughts on the Marcus Williams deal? You didn't include it in your grades. Curious what grade you'd get. I thought that was pretty much a market extension or a market signing. I didn't think it was good nor bad. You know, like they do with a lot of their deals, it is kind of, for the level of contract, I mean, it is pretty front-loaded in cash. That's just something that they do. You know, it's 16 over in the first year, which is, you know, a decently high figure. You know, it's not huge by any stretch, but I thought it was okay. You know, it was, you know, big guarantee, big 2 years kind of on it. I thought it was okay, and the numbers kind of were, I don't know, more or less, I think, where I expected them to be. So I wouldn't say good. I wouldn't say bad. I think it was just kind of there. Feel free to not answer this. What does OTC make in revenue per year, and what's the breakdown? B2C, does the NFL or certain teams pay you? We do consulting. I do consulting. I shouldn't say we. I do consulting. For stuff, you know, OTC is it's a side thing I do. It's not a primary source of income by any stretch of the imagination. You know, it's something I enjoy. It's a labor of love. I don't go crazy with the, you know, trying different things with the marketing and other nonsense. And I know we throw a bunch of ads on there. You got to pay the servers somehow. I don't have the time to sit there and do direct advertising and all that other stuff that, yeah, we kind of get requests about and, you know, those other things, but we do consulting stuff as well, that I do on the side and, you know, provide different types of services and data and that kind of stuff, but it's not my main line of work. Humbaba, what would be the ideal contract for the Ravens and Jackson? And is there a danger that without an agent, he might sign a Kaepernick type of deal? No, I don't anticipate a Kaepernick type of deal. I think that ship has sailed. The Kaepernick style deal, the 49ers struck that deal when there was still at least a couple of contracts and a couple of question marks that were there as to what was the value of a quarterback who was considered good, hadn't won stuff yet, you know, not a great postseason, but there was still enough there. Even though the Joe Flacco thing was already throwing chaos into everything, there was still enough, I think, enough of a question as to what really was and was not a market to get those deals done. Now, Kaepernick came in too low compared to where he should have been, and he took a ton of incentives to jump those numbers. But it was a little bit of a different time, and Jackson is not in that time right now. I think the biggest difficulty for Jackson without an agent is just that the Ravens do business different than other teams. Not that everybody, but the structure that they use, their selling points on these deals are typically a bunch of money the first like 2 years of the contract, and in return they expect a lower annual value. So you might get a player who would traditionally expect to be either, you know, by a small margin be the highest paid at the position, or be the second highest paid at the position. But what they'll do is they will end up getting them to be like the fifth highest paid at the position, sixth highest paid, but they'll make them the highest paid by a pretty good amount over the first 2 years of the contract. Buffalo kind of functions the same way. That's something that I think you have to have an understanding of, because people don't talk about that stuff. So, you know, when Adam Schefter tweets out something, unless you're really getting fed a line by people, it's not going to come with the you know, it's the highest 2 year payout in the history of contracts given to quarterbacks. You know, that probably wouldn't come out in any tweet. So that makes it a little more difficult, because the publicity that comes from the deals, and that's what most people are going to hear and most people are going to know about. It's just that, you know, player X makes 46 a year. Player X got $230 million guaranteed. You know, whatever the numbers are. Yeah, that's the Deshaun Watson deal. But, you know, that's the thing. And sometimes I think you get a little bit more nuanced with it. And that's not to say he won't understand that. I just know if you have an agent, you know, like a good agent, they will. And they'll understand the pros and cons of it and be able to walk you through it before you make an ultimate decision as to whether or not you want to do it. If I'm the Ravens, you know, I don't want to pay him top of the market. I'm too worried about his body not holding up, you know, to do one of these deals that essentially is going to be 3 or 4 guaranteed years that averages, you know, $50 million a year. I just don't think I would want to go there. I don't know. I wouldn't have the confidence in it. So I don't know. I've for the whole time, I have not thought that there is like a fair middle ground for the two sides. Like I look at it and I just don't see it. And Jackson, unfortunately, with the way he plays, he is one of the players who could probably get hurt and it would diminish his value. You know, while Dak Prescott was a mobile quarterback, Dak Prescott was mobile. He wasn't going to go out there and run for like 1,000 yards. That's part of Jackson's game, is his ability to really run with the football. So I don't know. I just don't think that one has like a happy compromise area. Do you think Derwin James will get more money on a contract than Fitzpatrick? Are they about the same player and deserve the same money? No, James is going to get more than Fitzpatrick. I think he'll be the first 20. But again, it's going to depend on if he can stay healthy. Similar to Brad's cap health rankings, how would you rank, consider the following factors when evaluating risk and cap management? Cash spent, total money under contract, prorated void years. Is that about right? Any others? So, yeah, I think... So generally what I would look at, if you're looking at a team's kind of their salary cap health, you want to look at flexibility, number one. So that's kind of, as part of what you're looking at there, the effective, the total money left under contract, not total money under contract. So you're kind of, every year, what I like to do is calculate a player's effective annual value. And what you do with that is you will take the remaining cap dollars, add up all the remaining cap dollars in the future and divide it by the number of future contract years to come up with a player's annual value. and see how that annual value compares to the actual worth of the player, whether it's his stated annual value or what you consider to be his value to the team. That shows you if you're really over or under invested in a roster. I think that does a really good job of capturing that. I think that's an important thing to look at. You want to look at maximum cap space that could be created if you had to push the emergency red button and start over like Chicago did. You know, what are the consequences of doing that? Are you completely destroying your team to where you can't function? Or can you create a lot of cap room by doing that? Then your other one is, well, what if we want to go in the other direction and we want to compete with the roster we have but still add to it, you know, go in the Saints direction? What kind of flexibility do we have to throw some void years on there, bring the salaries down to a minimum, and, you know, extend that money out? So you want to look at those factors and see kind of what that does. You know, in terms of void years, I'm not as concerned on the void years themselves. I'm not the hugest fan of void years. I think most people know that. But what I want to do with the void years is I want to see how the void years work in combination with the rest of the roster. Like, if I have a void year, if I have five players with void years, but their void years are all staggered, meaning, well, one guy's voids are going to hit in 23, then another one in 24, another in 25, another in 26, and another in 27, I don't care, because it's just one player a year. The problem is when you stack them to where you've got 3, 4, and 5 players hitting at once, because that compromises you. That gives a lot of leverage to a player looking for an extension, and it puts you in a really bad position if you don't want to keep the player and you need to make changes to your roster. So I think that's kind of the stuff that I look at. But, you know, for the most part, salary cap windows nowadays are no more than 2 years. Not enough long-term contracts, not a lot of meaningful, you know, dollars in there. The change in the rookie system, you really can't understate the way that that really did change the game in terms of the salary cap implications, you know, for teams. It really did. It really changed the game and made things a lot easier for teams. What's a likely scenario for Baker and the Browns and all this noise about a trade with the Panthers? I don't believe any of that noise. I think that noise is coming from the Browns, and that is noise for the Browns basically looking to hope that the Panthers want to get involved. How and when can the Titans get out of Tannehill's contract? I believe that's next year. I think next year is his last year under contract. Let me just take a look. Tannehill's last contract year is next year. I think it would be a real big mistake if they decide to extend him. It would be 18-8 dead to move on from him. Barring a Super Bowl this year, you know, if I was them, I'd probably start exploring what the trade market might look like next year. Unless they play great this season. I keep hearing the Commanders can't afford to sign McLaurin and Payne because Sweat and Young are coming up in ensuing years. My math says with increasing cap levels, it's definitely doable. Yeah, no, they can keep these guys. There's not an issue with them. Look, when you don't have a team that's very talented, and let's be real, Washington has not been very talented. They're not successful. Most teams in the NFC East have not really been very successful outside of the Eagles, and the Cowboys have had a year or two here and there. The Commanders right now have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They're 7th in cap room this year with about 18-4. Next year they project to be about 13th. Yeah, 13th. Next year, it's not a lot of cap room, but, you know, they do project 13th. So they're going to be middle of the league in what they have. And, you know, then in 24, and this is why I said you're looking only at 2 year cap windows, you know, their middle of the league is maybe they're like number 12 or 13 again. It's close to middle of the league, you know, $100 million in cap room. So they have room to do it. The only teams that you're ever going to see an issue with, when it comes to keeping the band together, are the teams that have the big quarterback under contract. Okay, that's number one, because that guy is going to immediately eat up a chunk of that money. And then they fill that with a couple other players making a lot. Like if you took a $45 million quarterback and then you put him on Pittsburgh with a safety at close to 20, an edge close to 30, and another lineman close to 18 or so, then you start having questions about what you can and can't do with the rest of the roster. When you don't have that quarterback under contract, and when you aren't a team that's been successful, that needs to pull every string to kind of keep the group together, you don't have those problems. You're making decisions based on either you're being cheap, which does happen, or more likely, you look at it and say, okay, we're talking about extending all these players, and they're all good players, but as a mix, has this worked for our team? And the answer is no. So if the mix hasn't worked, are those guys going to be part of the solution or not? And your solution is probably going to come from the draft, and you may not want to overplay your hand with all of those players, because by the time that next level of draft pick kind of is good, you probably are going to hit the declining stage for these other guys you're talking about extending. So that's that. Let's see. What else do I have here? When do you think the Rams' salary cap situation will mean they have to blow things up? So for the Rams, you don't have a worry for the Rams right now until 2024. And I'd have to look to even see how, really take a look at it to see how bad that could possibly be there. But 2024 would be the year, I think, that you would look at and, where they would probably have to make decisions, which probably wouldn't be about blowing it up, to be honest. It would probably be more about putting Band-Aids on. It would be more about doubling down on guys who, for as much as we like the doubling down on a Cooper Kupp right now and an Aaron Donald right now, you don't want to be doing that 2 years from now. You don't want to be extending an Allen Robinson type, but that might be the kind of situation that they look for then. How many TDs is Trey Lance throwing for next year? 35 or 40? I would guess much less than both of those numbers. I don't think he's going to have a big, I don't think he'll have a big season, but we'll see. I would love to hear your thoughts about the Bears' offseason strategy and their cap situation next year. So I talked about the offseason strategy before. The cap situation next year is great. So, I would say this year, I know you're always focused on the present, but I would take that turn towards planning for 2023 as early as possible for everybody on that team, with the exception of, the head coach. The head coach can only have a glancing eye towards 2023. Let him focus a little bit on this year, but you want to have everything in front of you. You want to know who are the real free agents versus, what players are going to get tagged. Who are the cut candidates from other teams? Who are the trade candidates from other teams? What can you do to improve draft capital? What do you foresee happening in the draft? You need to hit a home run next year. How come they don't call episodes peas since they're in a podcast? That's a good one. I don't know. Do you think Max Crosby can improve off his breakout season? I would say more likely you're probably going to see a decline. I don't think he's going to be bad. So I'm not saying that, but I don't think he'll improve. I think that, let me take that back. I think he could actually be a better player, but maybe not put up the numbers that would stand out as much. Titans fan from Argentina. Do you think Jeff Simmons will be the second highest defensive tackle after Aaron Donald, resetting the market for human DTs? Yeah, I you know, he's probably in a position to where, you know, maybe that can happen. You know, like I said, it's one of those things where I don't know, you can compare yourself to guys like Leonard Williams. You just can. And it's harder to, you know, compare to an Aaron Donald. And Donald being paid so much should open the rest of that market, you know, to be able to jump up. So, you know, I think he probably has the ability to get there, because I think you're looking, I'm just pulling up his stuff here, you know, 85% snap counts last year, 8.5 sacks is what we have listed for him, 16 quarterback hits, 12 tackles for loss. You know, I would say that can compare with Williams, who was, let me see what Leonard Williams was at. I don't have his pressure numbers up, but I can just pull up the top line at least here. You know, Leonard Williams, when he redid his deal, what year did he sign? 2020? He re-signed off the 2020 season. So, I mean, so in 2020, Leonard Williams was 74%, 14 tackles for loss, 30 quarterback hits. He had 11.5 sacks, so they had a big sack year that year. Off of, you know, basically a non-existent career with sacks. And, you know, he dropped back down to 6.5. So I'd say that the numbers probably compare in there. So I think there's a possibility that, you know, that could be one of the guys that that gets a big bump from the Aaron Donald deal. Do you think Aaron Donald and Von Miller, I'm assuming that's the AD and the Millers, will regress and ultimately not play to level their third contracts are valued at? You know, I don't know if regress is the right word. Aaron Donald will probably play to the contract for 1 year, and then I would say it's a question mark. I mean, he's an older player, so it's, you know, he would have to play at such a high level to continue being worth $30 million a year. You know, that bar is so high. You know, it's amazing if he could do that again. In terms of Miller, yeah, I don't see that, because Miller's deal is not really a 20 a year, but, you know, Miller last year, last couple of years, has not been the same guy. Going into the championship game, probably for the Rams, I think most people probably barely even remembered Von Miller was on the team. Certainly going into the playoffs, I think most people probably were going to look at that and say, you know, it was a try, it was a swing and a miss. Like, there wasn't much that really went on there that would, you know, make you get too excited about him. And then he's got the big run in the playoffs. Let me just pull up what he did last year with the Rams just to give you an idea. Let's see. His numbers on the Rams, 8 games, you know, 5 sacks, 31 tackles, 8 quarterback hits, 12 tackles for a loss. I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of quiet. You know, it's not the same. It's not the guy he used to be, you know, all those years. So really, you're looking at, you know, and again, we're just looking at sack levels and stuff like that, but his all-pro kind of career, I think, ended 2017, 2018, when he was at that kind of level. And, you know, he's kind of tailed off. And I think it was, I felt that contract was based too much on what happened last year in the playoffs. You know, in particular, I think it was the 3 games there. You know, then what he did the whole year, and when you're looking at coming back off injuries and stuff like that, I thought that it's probably too aggressive of a contract. Do I think TJ Watt and Vita Vea will perform at or above the value? So Watt, I don't think you're going to look Watt ever as above the value of the contract, just because it's so high and will be high relative to the market. So I don't think it'll be above, but I don't think he's, barring injury, I don't think he's going to hit a point where you start looking at it and going, he's overpaid. I think Vea has a chance to probably outperform his deal. Not saying that he will, but I would at least give that opportunity. I'm assuming this is a podcast question. I just got an email. Let's see. I was hoping you can get an explanation as to why Kareem Hunt's 2022 per game active bonuses of $200K apiece are all considered likely to be earned when he was only active for 8 games. All right, let me pull up Kareem Hunt here. Just give me a second. He had a interesting contract, let's put it that way. Yeah, he's a strange kind of, not a strange contract, just a different kind of contract here. All right, so his contract, as to why they're all valued this way, let me pull up what his deal is here. Okay, so for this year, so of his contract, of his stuff, all his stuff is basically based on being not suspended or not on some kind of non-football injury or illness list. His stuff is all based on 90-man roster status, at least from what I was told. So of his roster bonuses here, $500,000 is tied to being on the 90-man roster for the first game of the year. It's not a straight $200,000 a week roster bonus. This is one of those where we don't put all those details up there. And some of the reasons are that, we are the quote unquote verified source that goes for another website. So, you might see silly stuff for them, for some of those things. But here's the actual breakdown. It's $500,000 is just being first game. Then you've got $2.55 million is an actual per game bonus. That's probably paid out at 16 games, but it could be 17. I don't have that written down. Actually, no, that one might be 17. I'm not sure how they did that one. I don't remember how they categorized it, because he signed that deal in. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's $2.55 million per game for being on the 90-man roster. So he could be on IR, he could be inactive, and you would still earn it. And then you have $850,000 is a per-game bonus. For every game, you have to be on the 90-man roster, and on that final game of the season, you also have to be on the 90-man roster. You can't screw something up for one game and expect to, at the end of the year and expect to get paid for the season. So, I could look a little further into that and see, but the gist of it is that it's a little bit more of a complex contract. And I just double checked on it. It's actually that last one is just for final game. So it's a first game bonus, a last game bonus, and an official per game bonus. I dumped them all in the per game category. I just thought that made more sense, or was just easier to do. Than doing it the other way around. I just thought that made more sense for putting it there. And like I said, that when we get little questions like that, that's where we can be the quote unquote hidden verified source. Where you can see those little differences, in the websites, when it comes to that stuff. But that's the reason why his contracts are like that. It's because they carry a 90-man rider. And the only other player I remember with that to that level was DeSean Jackson had those as well at one point in his career. When it comes to per-game bonuses, you can have – everyone looks at them and they just assume 48, but some players get 53-man roster bonuses. Some will get a combination of a 48 and a 53. And then occasionally you'll get these that are for 90. So just know that when you hear per game, 98% of the time it means the 48-man bonus, to where you just look at how many games the player played and, is what it is. But for certain players, it's based on a 90-man or a 53-man condition, versus the 48. So, all right, that'll do it for me. Probably will not be doing a podcast next week unless we can't go away, in which case then I'll come up with something for next week. You guys will be stuck with me. If not, I'll be back in 2 weeks. So everybody have a great week, and I'll talk to you all again soon.